Welcome, everybody, to the New York Society Library. I'm Carolyn Waters. I'm the assistant head librarian. And I want to thank all of you for coming tonight. This is always a really fun evening. I want to send a very special shout out, especially to Jenny Lawrence and all of you who support the library through your memberships and your generous donations, without which evenings like this wouldn't be possible. So thank you again. Because you've come here tonight, you know, I have to think that you'll agree with me when I say that there's nothing more satisfying than, you know, discovering a great, you know, new literary magazine. It's funny because when I was a library student, I actually interned at New York Public Library in the periodicals division for an amazing librarian who oversaw their astounding collection of literary magazines. And I mean, this is a really astounding collection. It was a really incredible experience for me to get to peruse all these magazines, handle all these magazines from all over the country and all over the world. And I even got to read a lot of them. I was working. I had to read them. I was working. It was great. Great experience. But what it really showed me is that, you know, there's so much variety in these magazines, and a lot of them fly under the radar. A lot of them, there are so many of them that, you know, they have all different aesthetics, you know, different focus, different aspirations, but they're all defined by one thing. They're all a labor of love for the editors and staff that put them out, and they deserve our attention because they are rich in content, they're engaging and provocative, they are pure joy and entertainment, and it's really extraordinary to discover these magazines. So I've been holding these salons for a couple of years now as a sort of homage to my mentor at that other library, but also because to this incredible curated collection that our head of acquisition, Steve McGurl, has amassed here at the New York Society Library. And if you haven't checked it out, it is a really terrific assortment of magazines. And it's always here in the members' room, so those of you who are members can definitely come and check those out. My hope for these evenings is that, you know, by giving the magazines, giving the editors and the contributors a chance to talk about their mission and read from the magazines, that you all will discover a great new read. You know, I know you all need something more to read, right? You don't have enough to read. But they really are worth taking a look at, and we've been subscribing to Tweed since its previous incarnation as the Coffin Factory, so we've had this in the collection for a little while. So tonight I'm very pleased to hand over the podium to Laura Mae Isaacman, who is one of the founders and editors of Tweeds and the Coffin Factory, its previous incarnation. So please give Laura a big round of applause.
I'm Laura, and I just want to start off by thanking you all for coming out here tonight, to Carolyn and everyone at the New York Society Library, to inviting us to this event. It's a great honor to be here and to be able to talk about our magazine and introduce it to those of you who are not familiar with it. It means a lot to us as a small magazine to be able to have these kinds of events and to have people like you show up to them. And I also want to thank you on behalf of our readers, Nicole and Ray, who worked really hard on their work and are really great to work with, and I know put a lot of effort into their pieces that we publish in the magazine, and I know they're really grateful for you all coming here. So I want to start off by talking about The Coffin Factory, which was our previous magazine, which we began in 2011. And I sort of want to start talking about it because The magazine differs a lot from Tweeds in the fact that the Coffin Factory was very heavy literature-based. So we had a lot of interviews with publishing houses about the material they publish and what makes each house different from the next. So we had interviews with New Directions and Other Press and Overlook Press and FSG about their material and what they're really aiming to do with their publication and the kinds of work they're looking for. The reason that we switched over from the Coffin Factory to Tweeds, and I'll play a short video in a moment, was because we, in setting out with the Coffin Factory several years ago, our aim was really to be able to discuss topics that were important to us. And through publishing a couple of issues, we kind of got really narrowed in on a focus of literature. And we came to a point after our fifth issue where we really wanted to expand beyond that and talk about things that were a little more socially and politically relevant to what's going on in the world today. So our aim with Tweeds is more to engage some writers that we really, whose work we really care for, and take the topics of their books, like the environment and religion and sexism, and to talk to them about the larger ideas behind their books. So I'm going to just play a short video for you right now. It's only 2 minutes, and it was part of our fundraiser that we did to kickstart Tweeds, and it explains a little bit about the transition between the Coffin Factory and Tweeds. Okay, so Tweeds magazine. So these are our first two covers, our first two issues, and we feel they're pretty representative of what we're trying to achieve with the magazine. Let me start by why we named it Tweeds. If anyone is familiar with the Civil War era politician known as Boss Tweed, William M. Tweed, he's kind of recognized as a symbol of American greed and corruption, and so we really wanted to... We really wanted to comment on modern-day society and how pretty much everything is corrupted by money. Obviously, the whole political system, but even our medical industry and our academic institutions are pretty corrupted by money. So we really wanted to comment on that. And we felt that the cover for issue one, Man Staying in Balance, was kind of like mankind. Trying to stay in balance with all these crazy things that are going on. And for issue two, Controlled Burns, it's sort of our unofficial theme of World on Fire. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the content of the first and second issues of Tweeds, and I'm going to break it down into four categories, the kinds of things that are repeated over and over through the interviews and that are important to us, such as the environment, literature, religion, and sexism. So I just want to start with an interview that we had with Dale Jameson. His most recent book is Reason in a Dark Time, Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future. And in the interview, he spends a lot of time talking about the long history that has been in the political conversation about climate change. I mean, this is not anything new. People have been talking about it for decades, but the reason that nobody has done anything about it is because they don't really know how to solve the problem. I mean, on one hand, you know, we can accept that there is climate change. There are time-lapse photographies, videos of glaciers melting. But on the other hand, it's really easy to deny the problem for this reason. He says that evolution built us to have a certain set of sensory responses to a certain kind of stimuli. So because humans have not evolved to respond to things that they can't immediately sense, it's difficult for us to come up with a solution for climate change. Especially, he says, that the interesting thing about human psychology is that we don't like to believe that there's a problem unless we know the solution. And the problem with climate change is that people don't see the solutions, and that makes them want to deny the problems. And the interview is very interesting because he talks at length about this, and he also, towards the end, paints kind of an eerie picture about what the world will look like in the future once it has been affected by climate change, and how, to people that have seen that transition and have lived through that transition, will be pretty much horrified by it, but by those who have been born into it, will just kind of accept it as that's how life is. So in the first issue, we had Dale Jameson write an essay with Bonnie Nasdem about Edward Bertinsky's art. And Edward Bertinsky, in this series, in his water series, photographs a lot of environmental damage. And the essay is about the contrast between the beauty in a piece of artwork and what it's actually depicting. And this is an oil slick and how it's completely damaged the oceans, and you can see it just goes on and on. But yet there is still beauty in this image, and how do we deal with that? So how do we deal with the beauty of such an arresting image that's depicting such a horrific thing? Oh. And here's another picture from the same series that is showing the Gulf of Mexico. So another thing we really are very interested in at Tweeds is religion and how it affects people and how it affects community and people's actions and the way people join together and identify themselves. So we sat down with Reza Aslan, whose most recent work, Zealot, was a depiction of the historical Jesus, and that generated a lot of controversy for people because it sort of went against what people understand the history of Jesus to be. So he talked a lot about religion as a form of identity, and that people really use it to join groups and to identify with one another and feel like they are a part of something and to find community. And he says, the thing about identity, and particularly collective identity, is that it often requires a negative pole. So it requires an other to identify yourself against. And what does it mean that I am part of this group? It means that there are members either within this group or outside of this group that I define myself against. And he says, this is the problem because this is where nationalism comes from. It's where ethnicity comes from, and every marker of identity is defined by its opposite pole. So he talks about how that's sort of problematic in terms of religion and identity, is that you're really defining yourself by what you are not. And he says, you can reject religion, and you should, because it's a man-made phenomenon, but faith is more primordial. And then we spoke to Edwidge Donnicott, and her interview has sort of a lot of different themes. A lot of our interviews have a lot of crossover among these themes. But I wanted to talk about her sense of religion, because she really talks about that in her latest book, Claire of the Sea Light, which is based on a small fishing town in Haiti, and they're suffering from severely unequal social structures that they're dealing with and they're facing every day. And there's a really gripping line in her book that says, some executioners cross themselves before they shoot their victims. So she talks a lot about people using religion in order to justify their beliefs, and obviously wrongly in some cases. So she says, of course she sees religion like used as a vehicle for doing good and for building community, but many people feel that their interpretation of their particular religion or ideology gives them permission to hurt others, to even kill. And they feel like they're on the right side, they're on God's side. And she says, of course, I can't speak for God, but I don't think that putting another person's life at risk or killing them for their beliefs or who they are is a God thing. So in these two interviews, you really have a scholar and a writer talking about religion and how it's misused and how it certainly can be abused to cause harm for other people. So we try and explore those topics. Also, religion can be a wonderful, beautiful thing to build community and to give people faith, but that a lot of time it is misused. And those kinds of things are exemplified in their books. We also obviously love to talk to writers about literature, always, to get their feedback on what they think of literature, what do they think the importance of it is. And so we interviewed John Freeman, who was the editor of Granta, and his latest book, How to Read a Novelist, is a selection of very short, like two-page interviews. They're very short, profiles of authors. So we'll sit down with an author for several hours, and he'll come home and he'll write just a two-page profile about them and saying basically a summary of their interview. So it's a very different and unique way to interview and showcase an author. He's reviewed over 1,000 books for some of the most respected publications, and he's been doing book reviews for several decades. So we talked to him a lot about the changing landscape of print, how newspapers are shrinking their book review sections. We talked a lot about what makes a good or bad book review, like plot summary versus actually incorporating things that are going on in one's own life into the book review, and the impact of reading on the individual, which he says, reading is not about wisdom, but it's about trying to make sense of our existence. All the stuff you learn about characters in books, you eventually, in some deep way, unless you're a moron, start applying to yourself. This is making me sound very old-fashioned, but I don't see the point of reading otherwise. So that's really inspiring for some of us who read a lot and sometimes feel bad about it. it's a good thing, I guess, ultimately. And then one of probably our coolest interviews was Naveen Kishore. He runs a publishing house out of Calcutta. And he is very, very spicy. His interview he's very fresh, but he's also pretty brilliant. And Siegel Books, if you're not familiar with them, they specialize in English translations of works from all around the world. This interview particularly meant a lot to us because he puts the whole business of books into a perspective that you don't normally see it, which is really inspiring for us as a small magazine. We strive a lot for aesthetics and to make our product high quality and to look good. We choose our art very specifically. We spend a lot of time pairing art with literature and really paying attention to the order in which stories are lined up in the magazine. It's very important to us, and less important to us is the rest of the business, like the elements of running a business, are kind of on the back burner for us, which we're fine with, which makes the magazine fun and enjoyable for us. But it's really inspiring for us to hear the successful publisher who has the same exact mindset as us. I mean, if you've ever seen a Siegel Books catalog, they are beautiful. They are they have suede covers, this beautiful, glossy, thick paper, really ornate designs, poetry throughout, just random poetry. It's absolutely gorgeous. So he puts a lot of work into the aesthetics of his projects. And he says, there is no business plan, except that the belief that it will all even out if you persist. And here the word persist is not simply about romantic grit. It means use all the means that are possible to make the business of books work. How? By juggling, borrowing, seeking like-minded people the world over, and persuading them to your cause. So I highly recommend for anyone who is starting a new project or any new endeavor to read this magazine, because it will inspire you. I mean, I'm sorry, read this interview, because it will inspire you a lot. Okay, so we also sat down with Amy Grace Lloyd, and her debut novel was The Affairs of Others. Amy Grace Lloyd is really interesting for us because she spent 7 years as the fiction editor of Playboy, and then about 2 or 3 years ago, she left Playboy to work at Byliner, which is a publication that publishes, I don't want to say stories because they don't really have a specific length requirement. It's stories and novellas online, digitally. And so she talked a lot about changes in the editorial market in terms of what publishers are looking for when they publish work or when they select work. And I found out some really disturbing things about other publications that I won't, you know, specifically name. But I guess actually it also applies to Playboy and Byliner. she had said that when she started out, she says, both at Playboy and at Byliner, I found that the mandate when I first arrived was to find as much literary work as possible, to reach for more than celebrity culture, to associate ourselves with thoughtful, engaged, and innovative writers. But, she says, then the demands of commerce and fear crowd in, and suddenly my bosses want as commercial a name as I can get them. It's suddenly about bottom lines and eyeballs and traffic and traffic and traffic. Something that's really disturbing, it was incredibly disturbing for us to hear, and is completely opposite of how we work, is that everything in publishing has become about numbers. So it's not only about your profit for the magazine, but it's also about, they choose stories based on how many Twitter followers an author that they're considering has, which I think is completely... has no place in literature, has no place in running a magazine or any sort of publication, and you're not really being true to the author or the work if you're going by something like how many followers someone has. So I'm talking that even if somebody has 30,000 followers compared to someone who has 90,000 followers, that means that certain publications will not publish the work of someone who has 30,000 Twitter followers because they only have 30,000 Twitter followers. So my question is, what does that mean for the rest of us? What does that mean for people who don't have any following and for new writers? It doesn't really give them the chance to get their work out there. We also talked to author Sjón. He's an Icelandic author, and he recently had three books published at once by FSG, From the Mouth of the Whale, The Whispering Muse, and The Blue Fox. And he's really interesting because he talks a lot about mythology and storytelling, and basically how mythology is in every author's work, whether or not they realize or whether or not they're trying to do to incorporate mythology. And he believes that no matter what you're telling, whether your scene is magical, whether your person is turning into a tree or a man is turning into a fox, the writer is a craftsman, and it's the writer's job to believe that the person is turning into a tree and to convey to all the readers that the person is actually turning into a tree. And it doesn't actually matter what's going on and how much truth is in what's being written. It's how you're presenting it. So he talks a lot about really crafting a story and what that means to be a writer. And he says, right from the beginning, I've been a reader of many different stories. Somehow came very naturally to me to use these styles of writing, to see the great library of man as all these thousands and hundreds of thousands of attempts to describe what it is to be human, which is really, I guess, what we're doing in every story that we tell. Another topic that's really important to us and really interesting is sexism and gender bias in the arts and in the world. So we sat down with Siri Husvedt, most recently the author of The Blazing World, which is about a female artist who presents her work under the guise of three different men because she believes that the art world systematically suppresses women. So we talked to her a lot about gender bias and sexism and how it was found not only in men but also in women and how women are sexist against other women and how they're perpetuating sexism whether or not they realize it. And she says, it's very difficult for us to accept a young, voluptuous, sexy woman as the image of intellectual superiority. And in the art world, that older women become greater artistic forces in their fields once they've sort of aged out. And she says, older women don't lose their sexuality. They lose their identity in the wider world as desirable sexual objects. Because unlike the intellectual man, the intellectual woman is not supposed to be an erotic object. So the conversation sort of took a lot of different terms and incorporated a lot of neurobiology, psychology, and even irony. Like I said, our interviews are pretty layered and they're not really focused on one topic. These are just certain things that I'm choosing to highlight here. And I think it's important also on sexism and gender bias is to talk about Lapika Pelham's essay. Some of you may be familiar with her film, Deadly Honor, or her recent memoir, The Unlikely Settler. And her essay is about domestic abuse among Israel's Arab population. So there are a lot of crimes against women in the name of family honor, and her essay specifically in her documentary also sort of takes a story of a young woman, Samia, who was shot 5 times, twice in the head, by her cousins because they didn't believe the type of lifestyle that she was living was a lifestyle that she should have been living, and by that I mean just daily, day-to-day events, going in and out of the city, hanging out with her friends. So it really talks about this problem in Israel among the Arab population. It's a very, very small fraction of society, but there are certain families who feel that that if a woman is texting or talking to men that are outside her family, that that's a disgrace to the family and that that's problematic and in some cases ends in death. The problem with stopping this or to putting a hold on it is that the Jewish police force thinks that it's an error problem, and a lot of people within the community don't want to talk about it, and so by not talking about it, they are sort of perpetuating it, and it's a hard problem to solve or convict anyone by because the families are quick to cover up the evidence and don't report it, and then when somebody comes looking and investigating, they don't want to say anything for family honor. So that was really interesting to learn about and to discuss. And then I just want to close up with our art. This is, of course, only a fraction of the kind of art that we publish, but this painting is by Lisa Alonso, and it's from her series Vanilla Scented Sovereignty. And her images are very inspired by mass media, and her aim is sort of to depict the destroyers of humankind. So as part of this series, there are tanks and there are grenades made out of roses, as you can see. But she also includes a lot of fast food and like soda products and stuff. And so her aim is to juxtapose something beautiful like flowers against something ugly like the war and mankind. And this is probably my favorite artist of everything I've ever published, Matthew Brandt. This is from his series Honeybees, and these are actual honeybees that he has glued to the canvas. And it's his response to colony collapse disorder, which is the dying off of the bees. And he created this series in response to after he was walking along the shoreline in California, just seeing hundreds of dead and ailed bees, and he was inspired to create something using that and to make a statement about the environment and what's going on with colony collapse disorder. And that brings my presentation to a close. So thank you all for listening. And I would like to now introduce one of our readers, Nicole Treska. She has had fiction published in Moonshot Magazine and The Coffin Factory, which some of you have copies of, issue 3. And she also writes reviews for The Common. And tonight she will be reading from her short story, Manas, which we published in issue 2. So please welcome Nicole Treska.
Okay, I'm going to try not to be too loud on this. Thank you, Laura. That was excellent. And thank you for having me and to all of you for being here to listen, and to the New York Society Library for letting me read in this amazing space. I will do my best to fill it up. So this is my story, Manas. I remember dark nights and country roads with no lights and steep drops, and our daddy saying that in the case of a moose in the road, the thing to do was hit it hard. Everyone swerved, he said, a foolish instinct to save a stupid animal. You swerve and you hit a tree, or you drive off a cliff. You see a moose, you speed up and hope to knock it clean out the way. Thing is, with legs that high, a moose is liable to drop right on top of you. A moose in the road means trouble is already upon you. Someone's getting hurt. Only question is who. The day the moose turned up, we were awful bored, like hurt yourself bored, and had decided to throw my little sister, who had the unfortunate position of being youngest, to the pigs. It was the late afternoon of a late summer day, so somehow all of my days in Maine. Tall grass, ticks and flies, and lilac, purple and white on the wind, in bloom one day and wilted the next. That year, I was 7, and Billy the neighbor, she was 9. She wore a back brace made of hard plastic that squeezed her tight and kept her spine from sagging. Her mother called it an accident of nature, said there wasn't anything anyone could do about it. Billy's brace screwed into a metal frame that grew into a chin rest, which, by design, thrust her gaze slightly skyward. Her shoulders sloped, and when she ran, it kind of looked like she was skipping. The effect was unfortunate, but Billy walked around like farm royalty, squeezed into some rarefied country corset. Sometimes, when she asked, I would turn the ridged metal knobs that punctuated her plastic back like a spine, loosen the brace a little, so she could breathe. Billy was what my mother would call a real mana, the meaning of which I could never quite gather, save that it was not the most flattering thing my mother could say about you. I liked Billy fine, plus she lived next door and that made us friends. Our sisters were small, dirty, and younger than us, thus well suited to one another. We played hide and seek in the yard that attached our properties, large enough for hills to roll and trees to stand in thatches, for the chicken coop that was theirs and the storage barn that was ours, and filled with the dulled blades of farm equipment, tired out, but blades nevertheless. In the barn, the old cat killed mice and dragged them into the hollow walls to tear their guts out. She was a ferocious thing, and our presence bothered her not at all. She would trot past where we were folded between scythes and rotors with a head pinched in the side of her mouth, without so much as a sidelong glance. She worked tirelessly, the way everyone on a farm works, and was not much for chit-chat. It smelled of rotting rodents and wet hay in there, and it was where we did our best hiding. Our daddy was rebuilding an old Ford when he felt like it, and the car sat on blocks in the middle of the barn. The engine hung from a hoist like a heart on a chain, and the scent of thick motor oil almost masked the scent of dead mouse. I'm going to skip a section where the kids play hide-and-seek in the barn, and then they get bored and leave the barn and go and find their mother speaking to their grandfather, who is down in the pig pen. Frank, the girls are coming. Couldn't you do this later? Our mother would not go so far as to call her relationship with our daddy's daddy all sunshine and rainbows. Dead pig, incoming, came our grandpa's reply from down the hole. He flung a dead piglet up over the edge of the pen, and it landed small and sudden, stiff and mud-crusted in the grass. The piglets were not so small we could hold them in our hands anymore, Now they ran in little packs, squealing and delighting in games and mud baths, with their tails coiled exactly the way you'd think. We got on capitally. "Don't be afraid," our mother said as we neared the white piglet that had been pink when last we'd seen it, and part of life. "Why shouldn't we be afraid?" Billy's sister said in that way of hers that sounded either sage or stupid, depending who you talked to. "It was an accident," our mother said. "Grandpa said the mama crushed the baby. Let's hope it happened quick." She was pregnant then, and my youngest sister took to worry in the womb. Our grandpa hitched himself up the ladder and out of the pen. As grandpa's went, ours was not of the butterscotch variety. He did not slip a tenner in your pocket. He had better things to do with a knife than whittle. His was a high, sour smell in every room our grandpa lived in, and every shirt he owned smelled of his toil. He wasn't sure of our names, so he avoided most direct address. Speaking to no one and everyone all at once. That was the kind of grandpa we had. "He never really loved your daddy, remember that. He's a brave man, but he's cold," our mother said. She wasn't talking to us anymore. She looked toward a remote place ahead of her, like she was trying to put something together. She fancied the domestic pastimes of Maine, our mother did, and took to basket weaving and berry picking with studied attention, sure that if she became the housewife that pickled and jarred and quilted, that she could seal up the life she wasn't given and save it for leaner times, hold it in her hands and count it. She used to sew in a small room on the third floor of the farmhouse. She made all of our clothes up there, and once we were outfitted in smocks and blouses, she switched to quilts. Quilting needles are thicker, and they punched through the fabric and stuffing with such a force that the thin floors trembled right down to the ground. She was running off an edge one day when her thumb slid under the foot guard, and quick as that, the needle punctured her nail in the soft flesh underneath, coming to rest in its reservoir, leaving her thumb impaled and bloodless on the bobbin plate. It was not the pain that made her put the machine away for good, she said, but the ease, the swiftness with which something bad had happened. She was liable to brandish sunken thumb as cautionary tale, looking hard at her little daughters, waiting for us to understand what kind of a world we lived in. I remember the quilt, a spiral of black fabric with tiny bunches of purple and white lilacs, like the ones in the yard. We watched her walk off across the grass grown long enough to sway against her legs. The mottled old cat slept somewhere out of sight, and Grandpa had not yet emerged from the woods. We were alone again. My sister wiped the back of her wrist across her face and pointed into the pen. "You think there's another dead baby down there?" she said. "Someone should check," I said, knowing full well my grandpa would never, but going ahead because I could see by my sister's face she would let me. "Youngest first," I said, and the other two nodded in vigorous agreement, happy the task had not fallen to them. The pig pen was not without its charms, of course, but given recent developments, no one was volunteering. My sister whimpered a little on the ladder, but kept on anyway, fingers and toes slippy on the rungs. Below her, the pigs rolled in smooth circles, staying cool and tickless, despite everything. They were entirely without malice, but we were learning that malice had very little to do with death. We watched my sister with a newfound fear that something bad could happen. We could feel it hanging in our throats, somewhere above our guts, not quite making it to our mouths. It was then that the truck rounded the corner. Our daddy behind the wheel and theirs half out the window, hollering out the ruts in the road through a storm of dust. The front bumper was stove in pretty good, and the passenger side headlight dangled from its socket. When the truck bounced up and down on the dirt road, the light flashed off and on as if with sudden sight. The battered truck pulled up Billy's driveway and died with a convulsive groan. Our daddy climbed down with a hoo-wee to the whole world and walked around the bed, admiring the dead bull. Across the sea of lawn, they were gigantic. My daddy and the moose and my daddy, all shoulders and antlers, muscle and bone. The sun lit them up something special, and within its wide avenue, they were distant and gold. Their daddy pulled a cooler out from the tangle of legs in the truck and cracked two beers open against the tailgate. He took a deep drink, the kind where you really throw your head back, and handed the other to my daddy, calling out, "Baby girls, we had an accident." And we came running over those easy hills whose long grass held heat and ticks and a good deal of our youth spent running. "You think the hoist will hold him?" Billy's daddy asked. "Nah, arm's too short. Plus I got an engine up. We could pull him out, but then all we got is a moose in the dirt." Our daddies talked above us in the dreamy way of shocked or satisfied men. "Reckon it'll be harder now." "Yep." Meanwhile, us kids treated the whole affair like a low-rent museum exhibit. Previous to that very moment, the only moose we'd ever seen were live and giant, even at great distances. We knew them to be ornery, lacking all the demureness of deer. The commas of his nostrils swirled above his upper lip, and his cracked brown teeth were worn flat and stained dirty green. He had an equestrian face, a Roman nose, I guess you'd say. And even though his eyes were set more to the side of his head than straight on, he appeared distinguished. The little ones climbed over each other and into the truck, and I unthreaded Billy's back. When the brace cracked open, her chin peeled away from the chin rest, and she returned to her natural form, the way trees do after the wind comes. Billy's daddy lifted us into the bed before he made his way to the spigot on the side of the house to wash himself off. Even dead, the moose seemed to rise and fall. Perhaps it was the retinue of flies that attended him, so fat they barely flew, the mosquitoes and the gnats, the mites and smaller mites. Perhaps it was the deer ticks. There were the ticks you could see and the ticks you could only feel. The ones burrowed deep in the moose's coat. They were hard and blood fat and everywhere. Our daddy ambled over and watched us kick up dust off the dead moose for a while. He closed his eyes and something in him sagged. In repose, the hard little lines around his mouth and eyes accumulated to betray his cool. With his eyes still closed, our daddy said, "One second he wasn't there, and the next he was. Downright swift was what." Billy's daddy shot the moose to quit his suffering after our daddy couldn't do it, after he'd had to walk away from the smoking truck and the broken bull, whose groans he understood perfectly. The moose's fur was coarse. I pet his neck in the direction of the hole that ran to the heart that no longer knocked around. My daddy opened his eyes and said, "I suppose the odds of something terrible happening eventually are 100%. I watched the little one sitting atop the moose's belly and picking at ticks to distraction while I tried to make sense of what felt like some real important information. But Billy stood struck straight with understanding and looked at my daddy with terrible clarity. She picked between the moose's long legs and the rifles, the binoculars and brass bullets. Then in a moment, so graceful you'd never believe it to be Billy, she bowed and embraced our troubled daddy. "Come here," she said. "There's no real use in blaming." "Kamiya," was how she said it. Her chin pointed at the place where the trees met the boundless sky. Our daddy always referred to Billy the neighbor, named after her own daddy, as a real stand-up guy, no slouch. That was his big joke. He let Billy hold him longer than anyone generally held our daddy. Then he lifted her out of the truck and placed her on the ground, mindful of the soft S of her spine. After a moment, and with a thoughtfulness generally reserved for late nights at the lodge where the men drank whiskey and talked of solemn things, he said, "Not a one of us is meant to stick around. It ain't personal." We stood in the clearing the yard made, and the evening slipped down around us, promising the kind of night where the stars really throb and glow. Billy struggled back into her brace, and it took me till dark to twist her up good again, but it was all right. We were done playing. The creeping coolness that turned the lilac from purple to brown would be the same to send us inside soon enough. Thank you.
I don't know about you guys, but I feel proud as a mom's bird, as a mama bird, for her and her wonderful story. And I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. And please reread it because it's really powerful. Whole and when you're absorbing it by yourself also. Our next reader is Raymond Strum. Ray has had work published in Fiction Magazine both in 2007 and in 2014. And tonight he will be reading his short story Sisyphus and Lucifer, which we published in Tweed's issue 1, which has also just been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. So please welcome Ray.
Hello. I'm just going to read the first half of my story, so thank you for listening. At first there were whistles, young men in pickup trucks leaning out windows, leering, "Hey, pretty lady, look over here." Then came the yelling, "Get a haircut, faggot, you look like a woman." Sven Svensson was the first person I met in town, the only boy to stop his truck, saunter over, introduce himself. He called me ma'am. Spoke softly, politely, but when he saw I was no lady, his smooth talk turned rough. He told me he better not see me again. He said there'd be trouble if he did. I saw him nearly every day after that. He had as little going on as I did, and he spent most of the summer chasing me around in his truck. One day he chased me into a restaurant, and I was offered a job washing dishes. Another day into the Dairy Queen, where I met Jay and Mary, with whom I was good friends until all this happened, and they took off. Jay's house was unlocked, so I stepped in and shut the door. It was dark. I flipped a switch, but there was no light. Upstairs, two doorways were curtained off with bed sheets. At the end of the hall, a bathroom, also doorless. My face in the mirror. "You fucking hippie," Jay called from his room. "Where's my Nintendo?" Behind the curtain, I found Jay sitting naked on the edge of his bed, tracing the tattoos on his arm with his fingertip, an outline of an eagle, and below that, in an uneven hand, the word "dad." Next to him, under a thin blanket, Mary slept. "If you don't have those games, you better have some other way to make yourself useful," he said. I found the tray and emptied my pockets onto it and went to work in a chair near the window. Outside, Jay's pit bulls stood like statues. Sisyphus was large and round and sat at the end of her chain, head tilted, watching the cars and people pass on Elm Street. Lucifer was much smaller. He was allowed to run free, but never went far from his sister, who was tied to the trunk of the willow tree in front of the house. Jay stood and dressed in clothes that he found on the floor. Mary woke and asked Jay to get her hers, took them under the blanket. "Why so self-conscious, babe?" Jay asked her. "It's only Shane." "I can't do this now," she said, sitting up, shaking her head. "I have to go to work." She threw the blanket aside, stood up, and left the room. We found her downstairs in the kitchen, tuning a station on the television. Jay pulled a string that hung from the ceiling. The fixture clicked, but nothing happened. He opened the refrigerator. No light in there either. Took three cans and passed them out. "If that fiend is going to keep stealing the light bulbs," Jay said, "we're going to drink his pop." Mary slapped the top of the television. "Half the antenna is missing," she said. "What do you do with TV antenna?" Jay walked past me and Mary, went outside to see the dogs. Mary switched off the television and we followed him. Lucy and Sissy whined and barked when they saw Jay. They stood on their back legs and patted his belly. He grabbed their ears and patted their heads. The dogs licked his face when he crouched down to kiss them back. When he was done, we got into Mary's long brown Buick. After we dropped Mary off at work, Jay took the wheel. I climbed into the passenger seat and we drove back to the house to pick up Sissy and Lucy. The dogs weren't allowed in the car because they left short, thick, black hair all over, and they took turns chewing on the corner of the passenger seat. The upholstery was shredded, most of the underlying foam missing. Jay denied that this was proof that his dogs had been in the car. "Mary's pregnant," Jay said once we were heading south on the highway, and turned up the radio. Outside my window, sod farms rolled by, wide green fields split by thin patches of leafy trees and bushes, other people's grass before it was cut into squares and made into lawns. A single telephone line rose and fell along the road. I lit the joint I had rolled in back in Jay's room and passed it to him. "What are you going to do?" I asked. "She's going to keep it," he said. "Are you happy?" "These things happen. I'll deal with it. You got any money?" He turned off the highway and stopped at a gas station. I took $2.50s out of my pocket and handed them over. When he got out to pump, the dogs shifted in their seats and watched him through the back window. He went in to pay and came out with a small bag, a pack of cigarettes for me and another for himself. He unwrapped a piece of beef jerky, broke it in two, and threw one of the pieces over his shoulder. The dogs fought over it, and after Lucifer won, Jay put the other half in Sissy's mouth. "I do know one thing," he said, when we were back on the road. "The next 7 months will be my last chance at a real life." "Then it's over?" I asked. "Then the little guy comes," he said. For a while, we rode without speaking. I reached back through the seats to pet the dogs. Sissy had fallen asleep, and Lucy was quietly chewing on my seat. Jay pulled off the highway again and parked on a side street. The dogs barked and squealed when he got out of the car, walked around the corner. I dug in the grocery bag, found another stick of beef jerky, and split it for them. A few minutes later, Sissy let out a low, angry growl, and Lucy joined her. A familiar truck had appeared on the road and slowly rolled up to the car. Svensson. He angled his truck so no cars could pass and got out, 6 feet tall, all fieldwork and sunburn, cheeks swollen with tobacco, boots, hat, Confederate belt buckle. "Look what we have here," he said. "The long-haired faggot who wished he was a woman." The growling grew louder as he came up to my door. Reaching his arm through the window, he took some of my hair in his hand. "Just like a woman," he said, "just like a bitch." I leaned away from him, and Lucy lunged over my seat, closing his jaws around Svensson's wrist. He shook the dog off and took 2 steps back. Blood ran down his arm and dripped from his elbow into the street. Lucy barked, head out the window. Svensson walked backwards to his truck, eyes held on me. Stood there, staring, until a horn sounded behind him. When it sounded a second and third time, he climbed into his truck and went on his way, bloody arm out the window. Later, Jay and I were parked at the mall. There was a chemical taste, a feeling of smoking, but backwards. I looked up from my arm to see that a large wave had formed on the horizon and was moving towards us. Strong winds blew garbage and small animals around the car. My shirt and hair were flapping, and I ran my hands over my clothes to put them back in place. The wave was moving quickly, throwing everything into the air and letting it fall where it might. It began to rain. I closed my eyes and felt the car fly up. I flailed with both arms to hold on to something, but we didn't tumble or tip. The car landed right where it had been. When I opened my eyes, the wave was gone, the rain had stopped, and the wind was dying down. In my right hand was the door handle, and in my left was Jay's right. I looked up at Jay and then down at our hands and then up at him again before pulling mine away. Embarrassed, I stared out the window. The day had taken on a dead calm. The sun beat down on the blacktop. One of the dogs whimpered in the back seat. Jay lit 2 cigarettes and gave one to me, then started the car. "I was scared my first time too," he said. I didn't answer, so he reached over and grabbed my chin, turning my face toward him. "You don't need to feel bad or anything." Back at Jay's house, I sat in his chair with a notebook trying to describe the wave while he split and measured. He gave me my hundreds worth, then took some for himself and chopped the rest into a pile of gravel on a round mirror. He left the room and returned with a bottle of vitamins, taking 2 pills, crushing them to powder, and mixing that powder with the drugs. Then he put small amounts of the mixture on little squares of paper, which he folded into envelopes. "He didn't see me doing this, if anybody asked," he said, looking up at me. "Didn't see what?" I asked. The next day was the first day of school. Svensson arrived with the Confederate flag mounted in the bed of his truck. The flagpole had been welded in place and the flag secured to the pole with epoxy and twine. When he refused to remove the flag, he was asked to leave, suspended indefinitely. Someone handed out Confederate flag pins during lunch, and when those people wearing those pins were confronted in the afternoon classes, it became a matter of free speech. There was talk of demonstration. When school got out, there were news crews in the parking lot. Students with trucks had blocked the exits, and after the final bell rang, they climbed into the beds of their trucks and waved Confederate flags at the students leaving school. There were horns and yelling, punches thrown. One student with a bullhorn kept repeating, "The South will rise again." This went on until Svensson came speeding down the road, flag whipping behind him. The others pulled out of the lot as he passed, and soon there was a parade of more than 20 cars moving down the streets of Cambridge, promoting the revival of Confederate values. Thank you.
So I also urge you to finish reading that story, because that story gets a little crazy towards the end. And I really want to thank everybody for coming out here tonight. It really means a lot to us. I'm a good editor, but I'm kind of a nervous public speaker, so I appreciate everyone bearing with me, and I hope you guys had a good time. And if anyone has a question, you could ask me. Otherwise, you could ask me maybe after. No, okay. All right, well, thank you guys very much for coming.